Mr. Sinclair with the story of the bacteria revolution. On Ideas Tonight, Paul Ewald will say that chronic diseases never before imagined to be infectious are actually caused by bacteria. And David Relman will contrast traditional approaches to disease diagnosis with new and more accurate methods. On Ideas, Part 2 of the Bacteria Revolution, by science writer Coleman Jones.
Ideas about what causes disease have changed over the course of history. In ancient times, ill health was a punishment of the gods or the result of sorcery. In the Middle Ages, it was thought noxious vapors from decaying earth made people sick. Malaria was attributed literally to bad air. Finally, in 1867, a Prussian country doctor named Robert Koch showed that anthrax, a disease of sheep and cows, could be transmitted to mice, proving the modern germ theory of disease. Since then, a wide array of germs have been proven to be responsible for an equally wide array of human illness. But there's still a long list of chronic diseases whose causes remain a mystery. Cancer, arthritis, atherosclerosis, that's hardening of the arteries, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and Alzheimer's, to name just a few. It's been impossible to show a specific bug is behind these conditions, so investigation has focused on other factors. Poisons in the environment, inherited genetic mutations, and so on. While this research has yielded some important clues, the past decade has also seen other surprising discoveries that link bacteria to previously unexplained diseases. Some of these discoveries would never have been made using the traditional method of growing or culturing bacteria in the laboratory. That's the standard way to prove that a particular germ is making us sick. So as we enter the 21st century, it's clear that new tools are going to be needed to pin down the causes of chronic disease and to uncover what have been called the stealth pathogens. Tonight, I'm going to explore some of these new tools with the scientists who are using them. David Relman teaches medicine and microbiology at Stanford University.
My work concerns an effort to understand the kinds of microorganisms that cause disease which have been ignored or missed or unrecognized as causes of disease. My efforts focus on finding these organisms and understanding where they are, what they're doing, what their role in disease might be. I first became interested as a part of attending a clinical conference here at Stanford. We were listening to the presentation of a clinical case involving a disease that was well known at the time, but whose cause was unknown. The name of it is bacillary angiomatosis, and it was a very common disease in people with AIDS. And the clue was the visible presence of bacteria in tissues affected by this disease. And it was a puzzle, a mystery as to the nature of this organism and what it might be doing there. But the presumption was that it was the cause of the disease. And the problem was that it could not be propagated in the laboratory. It resisted cultivation, and for that simple reason, could not be identified, which points out one of the weaknesses of our traditional 100-year history of clinical microbiology, which is the dependence upon culture as a means of detecting and recognizing microorganisms. So I was sitting at this conference with my mentor, Stanley Falco, and we looked at these pictures of these bacteria, we heard about this case, and we looked at each other and thought, there's got to be a better way to understand the nature of these organisms. So we left the conference, and I returned to my lab, and I started thinking about culture-independent ways of detecting and characterizing microorganisms.
The ability to grow microorganisms in a laboratory culture, that is, in some stuff in a test tube, has up until recently been the only way to definitively identify them. This is because many germs look alike under the microscope, and it's only when you can grow enough of them to observe their behavior in culture that it's possible to distinguish similar-looking bugs from each other. That's why being able to grow a microbe in culture forms part of a series of rules or steps originally developed by Robert Koch to determine whether a given organism causes a given disease. The rules are called Koch's postulates. In essence, not only do you have to find the microbe in all cases of the disease, but you also have to be able to grow the organism in the lab and then reintroduce it into a healthy animal or person and produce the disease again. Then, and only then, can you declare the germ to be the cause of the disease. But Koch's postulates were based on ordinary bacteria, which are only one type of microorganism that can cause disease.
What happened was the recognition of an increasingly broad diversity of microorganisms, including viruses. Now suddenly, people were dealing with organisms that were notoriously difficult to propagate in the absence of another living cell, because, of course, viruses require another living cell in order to replicate. And now, almost by definition, it becomes impossible to purify a microorganism and ask it to replicate on its own without the use of another living cell. This began to complicate the picture and, in some cases, make it very difficult, if not impossible, to fulfill his original full three postulates for proving causation.
As a result, some researchers have suggested Koch's postulates are outdated and ought to be abandoned. Others take a more moderate stance. Richard Tilton, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Microbiology.
Rather than abandon Koch's postulates, I think we should modify Koch's postulates because it is possible now to detect the causative agent of a disease without isolating the organism.
One way of doing this is using a technique for homing in on a genetic material that makes up a disease organism and duplicating that genetic material millions of times. It's called PCR.
PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction, and I think maybe the best way to describe that is to use the needle in the haystack analogy. If there's one needle in a haystack, it's very difficult to find. However, if you can play tricks on that needle and make a million needles, then it's very easy to detect the needle in the haystack, and PCR does that. It takes very small quantities of genetic material, DNA, and amplifies it so that the DNA can be detected very easily.
Using PCR, medical detectives have been able to find previously undetectable microbes in all sorts of illnesses. One of these medical detectives is Garth Nicholson, scientific director at the Institute for Molecular Medicine in Huntington Beach, California.
Our work basically is on chronic illnesses, illnesses that strike actually up to 6% of the population of North America. We found that much of this chronic illness is due to stealth infections. These are primarily bacterial infections that have gone undiscovered or undetected in large numbers of people who are chronically ill. The reason that these have been undetectable infections is basically technological. The methods were not available to find these. These are infections that hide deep inside tissues. They're not easy to get at. And these new techniques and technologies have just really come to the forefront within the last decade. And before then, there was really no evidence that these types of infections were even present. Now that we can find them, we can study their role in the disease process much more thoroughly. And we can also monitor the patients during the course of their therapy, and this is quite important. If the microorganisms are involved in their disease process, then you should see the elimination of the microorganism with the recovery of the patient. And this is exactly what is being seen now in the clinic when it comes to these stealth infections. When you can successfully treat the stealth infection, the patients begin to recover from their illness to the point where you can no longer detect it anymore in their system. And I think these are, you know, again, some of the criteria that are important.
But they're different criteria than Koch used.
I think the overuse of Koch's postulates has resulted, it's really slowed the whole process down in terms of finding out the role of these types of infections in the disease process. And the main reason for that is these organisms are extremely difficult to culture and to obtain in pure form. And that's absolutely necessary to fulfill Koch's postulates. But we can fulfill many of the criteria in Koch's postulates just by being able to monitor the presence of these microorganisms and being able to monitor the disease process, for example, in animal models and so on. So although not every part of Kant's postulates may be easily fulfilled when we study these types of stealth microorganisms, certainly the overwhelming majority of them are. And I think that leads us to believe that there is just an excellent chance that these microorganisms are involved in the disease process.
But it's important to be sure you have the right bug. And with the advent of these new molecular DNA techniques comes the danger, the risk of blaming diseases on newly discovered microbes without stopping to think whether something else is involved. David Relman.
It's much easier to amplify or detect a DNA sequence or RNA sequence in a clinical sample than it is to attribute some important role to this putative organism with respect to disease, with respect to what it's doing there. As we start to apply these incredibly sensitive methods, we're starting to find that the diversity and number of organisms that occupy the human body, that spend time on or in the human body, is far greater than we had thought. And it really prompts us to ask, what are these things doing there? What is the meaning of finding sequence? And how do we go about showing that the presence of a sequence infers the presence of an organism that is responsible for a disease process?
Garth Nicholson.
There are a number of different criteria that need to be fulfilled before you can conclude that a given infectious agent, let's say a bacteria, is involved in creating illness. The first of these is that you have to find this at much higher frequency in patients who are ill compared to normal controls. The second thing is that you have to find much higher amounts, let's say in the blood of patients who are sick. You can't find it at superficial sites, let's say just like the oral cavity. It has to be inside the patient. We always use blood as a starting point for our analyses. Next, the patient should be responding against these infections, and this doesn't always occur. Sometimes a patient can't respond because the infections are buried deep in the tissues. Next, if the patient responds to a therapy, then there should be elimination of the agent. And also, the response of the agent should be differential to different types of therapies. For example, antibiotics. If antibiotics are used to treat the infection, the agent should respond only to certain antibiotics. And in fact, we found some antibiotics make the condition worse, so it's not a placebo effect. And then there's some other criteria, but they really have to do with injecting the organism into humans, and this is really not ethical any longer. But this has been done in certain instances, and I think the classic one most recently was the individual who developed the concept that microorganisms might be involved in causing gastric ulcers, and by consuming a beaker of these microorganisms, he could replicate the process in himself. With some of the stealth infections that we deal with, one would not want to try this because they're potentially lethal, and some people have actually died of these infections, and that's in the medical literature.
David Relman at Stanford.
I think that there are going to be a number of independent approaches, all of which will be necessary in building a case. There won't be one single test that tells us, aha, this thing means something, this sequence is the answer. Instead, I would argue that what we're going to have to do is go back and run through a list of possible experiments and approaches. In fact, I think one of the most interesting things about the use of these molecular approaches is the type of question and the kind of new concept of disease causation that's going to emerge simply from the use of these techniques, because I think we're going to begin to ask about some of the more complicated indirect relationships between disease and microorganisms, and the idea of mimicry is one example, that an organism elicits an immune response which is not only directed against itself, the bug, but also against a similar appearing structure that is human, that is host itself. And the organism at that point could disappear, leaving behind a process that is now self-propagating and directed against host tissue.
the shake where we shake bacteria, bacterial cultures, so we grow up our genes, our proteins in there. So we make liters and liters of bacterial cultures, and then we just light the bacteria.
We're on the 10th floor of the new Princess Margaret Hospital on University Avenue in Toronto. Groundbreaking research here is showing how certain bacteria can fool our immune systems into attacking not just the invading organism, but our own bodies as well. Dr. Tak Mak of the Ontario Cancer Institute heads up the lab.
Our immune system is set up to make very subtle differentiations between infectious agents and yourself. Of course, for infectious agents, you would like to turn your whole immune system all the way up to kill everyone of the infectious agents. But we are talking about millions of proteins that our immune system is processing. And there will be overlaps. After all, don't forget, we evolved from bacteria. Bacteria make proteins often to do the same work as our own proteins. And we've only been separated for several hundred million years in evolution. A lot of the proteins are still identical from a bacteria to a man. And so there will still be remnants of amino acid sequences that are shared. And when you mount an immune response against a bacteria or a viral protein, and they have shared codes, our immune system can go overboard and start attacking our own tissues.
Here are some PCR machines. So this is where we amplify our genes. And then, yeah. So this would basically
Joseph Penninger is giving me a tour of the University Avenue lab, which is funded by Amgen Canada, a division of the giant U.S. biopharmaceutical company. Dr. Penninger studies how the genetic structure of microbes can mimic parts of our own body.
We work on this model with autoimmune inflammatory heart disease. We got into this because we're working with a virus called the Coxsackie B3 virus.
The Coxsackie B3 virus rarely causes problems in adults, but it can cause severe autoimmune inflammatory heart disease in children who haven't developed resistance to it.
The virus infects the heart. It leads to destruction of heart muscle, and then the immune system, our own immune system, starts attacking the heart. So the chronic heart diseases, or certain parts of chronic heart disease occurs because the virus initially attacks the heart, and because the virus kills the heart muscle cells, the proteins are spilling out, and our white blood cells start attacking the heart muscle. So then we actually were looking for the protein in the heart muscle, which was responsible for that, because the white blood cells needed a target to a place where they can really attack. And so after a long time, we actually found this protein, and this is the protein which makes our heart muscle pump. So it's actually the motor of our heart. And a little part of this protein, so if you take this and put it into a mouse, they come down with severe heart disease. So half of the heart is destroyed within 21 days after you put it in. And so this was really exciting, and we fully expected there should be a virus which might look similar to this one because of the concepts of mimicry, of copycatting. So we looked for a viral infection or a connection between heart disease. But what came up was really chlamydia.
The full scientific name is Chlamydia pneumoniae. It's already known to cause pneumonia and bronchitis. Another kind of chlamydia is responsible for vaginal infections and blindness. Joseph Penninger, along with his colleague Kurt Backmeyer, was able to show that a piece of the Chlamydia pneumoniae germ bore a striking resemblance to a protein in our own heart muscle. He did this by lining up the genetic sequences of chlamydia and the heart muscle protein using DNA databases he found on the Internet.
We had access to this modern genomic tools, and without this, there's no way we would ever come across them.
Could you have figured this out using traditional criteria, like Koch's postulates?
This would be very difficult to actually prove it with Koch's postulates. So he basically postulates that you have to isolate the infectious agent, you have to culture it, you have to put it into somebody else, and they should all develop heart disease, right? If this is the simple case. And of course, with our model of mimicry, there's no way the postulates would actually give you this link.
So what you're suggesting is that there may well be bacterial culprits involved in a number of these chronic conditions, but because of the fact that they could just come in, do their little molecular mimicry trick, and then basically split, that has made it very difficult to finger any specific bacteria.
Yes, exactly. That's the idea, and this, of course, hampered probably the research a lot. I think they missed them for a long time because of the really could not fulfill this Koch's postulate. So why would you assume a bacterial infection if you cannot really prove it, what needed to be done in the textbook? And here's actually the bench where Kurt Bachmeier found that chlamydia peptides look like heart muscle proteins.
Right here, exactly, right here.
On Ideas Tonight, our program is about the bacteria revolution, and I'm Coleman Jones. We've been listening to Joseph Penninger talking about some very devious ways bacteria can cause health problems. For years, there's been a suspicion that they're involved in heart disease, especially since some people treated with antibiotics for other reasons seem to have fewer heart attacks. But no one had been able to definitively prove a connection between chlamydia pneumoniae and heart disease. That is, until February 1999, when Penninger and his colleagues published their findings in Science magazine.
Our paper made the first causal link to say the bacteria are not just this innocent little bug sitting around there. They can actually trigger heart disease. And I think our model explains lots of data, lots of anecdotal data, why there are people who have no risk factors are getting sick, why some people who are smoking and drinking and are obese never get heart disease. Right? It's just anecdotal. Our model can completely explain this. Also, our model can explain why in some circumstances antibiotic treatment help against heart disease. And as long as nobody else comes up with a better model, I think it's fairly reasonable assumption that this contributes to heart disease.
But what about the questions it doesn't answer? For example, chlamydia bacteria are widespread in the population. Why do so many people seem to escape the effects of the chlamydia bacteria and not suffer heart disease?
Actually, our model explains that. And the reason is that how our white blood cells are seeing chlamydia, they see little parts of chlamydia. And they see these little parts of chlamydia in association with a molecule we call MHC, which picks little parts of chlamydia up and shows it to our white blood cells. And then they're attacking it.
MHC stands for Major Histocompatibility Complex, a part of your immune system's built-in control mechanism.
And these molecules are very different between different people, meaning my MHC molecules would pick a different part of chlamydia up than the MHC molecules of some other person. So if I am unlucky and my MHC molecule shows this part to the immune system, which looks like my heart, then they are tricked. But the next person, they might as well pick up another part of chlamydia, so the immune system kills chlamydia, but they never attack the heart. So I think it's actually a reasonable explanation. But what we, of course, have to figure out is why does the treatment work for one person and not for the other?
The answer may have to do with when someone takes antibiotics. If the autoimmune reaction produced by chlamydia has already started, it may keep on going even after the bugs are killed off.
Yes, I think this is exactly the problem. Because we think the bug is probably the trigger, and then autoimmunity occurs, and then when autoimmunity is established, it's self-maintaining. And I think that's probably the reason why some people are reporting antibiotics are working. And this would actually mean you probably hit chlamydia infection very early.
Mm-hmm. So antibiotics given for heart disease might well work while the bug is still there, but once it has told the immune system to attack proteins either like itself or similar to itself in the host, the bug can go away, and the antibiotics at that point really won't do much good.
Exactly. That's the idea.
But this business of molecular mimicry is only one mechanism bacteria use to make us sick. David Relman at Stanford University.
There are also examples of disease where an organism may still be present, but it may not be alive. It may have died and simply persist in the form of pieces of the organism, which alone are sufficient to perpetuate some kind of immune-driven response that's responsible for a disease. Another example might be an organism that releases a toxin that alone is capable of causing a disease. The organism may be lurking in an anatomic site which you'd never think to go looking at. An example is toxic shock syndrome. We know there are cases of toxic shock that can occur when a person is infected with the Staph aureus that carries this toxin gene. And the Staph aureus can be responsible, it could be lurking in a little tiny abscess, a little boil, or pimple even, someplace in the skin that you wouldn't have ever questioned or started examining. But the toxin that it releases becomes bloodborne and disseminates throughout the body and causes this devastating systemic disease. Sometimes it becomes impossible to find where the organisms are that are releasing the toxin. So these are all scenarios that are going to severely challenge our ability to find and detect the causative agents. And I personally like the idea of embarking on a search using methods that are broad. So in many cases, you find a particular group or number of groups of people who favor bug A and look only for bug A in that particular disease, and you find other groups that favor bug B and look only for bug B. What I like is the idea of using methods which are nonspecific, that could find any bacterium, for example, or any of a large family of viruses if they are present, because it may be that some of these diseases are really multifactorial. It could be that MS, as we define it, can be caused by 3 or 5 or 10 different organisms if given the right host and the right opportunity. So there may be more than one answer, and that's what's difficult for the public and for the non-scientifically inclined, is that there's going to be no one study which is going to give everyone the answer. It's really going to be an incremental process. It's going to be the second and the third and the fourth studies that all happen to stumble upon the same bug using different methods that start to really put the nail in the, you know, the first nail in the coffin.
The idea that we have been using dangerously outdated methods to find infections is one shared by Paul Ewald. He's an evolutionary biologist at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and he's been thinking a lot about various infections and the diseases they might cause.
People have worked on the misunderstanding that many fewer diseases are caused by infection than really are caused by infection, and the way to evaluate whether this is in fact been the case is look at the track record. And over the last 100 years, really, the track record is that we have a steadily increasing number of diseases that we accept as being caused by infection.
Paul Ewald has put forward a radical idea, dubbed the New Germ Theory of Disease. It says that most of our chronic killers, from heart disease to Alzheimer's to cancer, must be due to infection.
Many people have made the arguments that a lot of human diseases for which there was no obvious infectious causation could be caused by bad genes. And on the face of it, that sounds fairly reasonable. Sometimes you can even find that those diseases will run in families. You can even identify genes that seem to be responsible for those diseases. But if those diseases have a strong negative impact on the survival and reproduction of the humans that harbor the diseases, and if they're pretty common, it's very unlikely that these diseases will be caused strictly by genetic mutations, strictly by bad genes, because those bad genes will be lost through time because of the negative effects that the disease has on the people who would harbor those genes for the disease. So, right at the outset, when you see diseases that are very common and that have a strong negative effect on survival and reproduction, if they're strong enough, they're common enough, you can rule out strict genetic causation. Now, this is surprising for people because sometimes people will say, but we know that there is a genetic basis for something like Alzheimer's disease or something like atherosclerosis. But one has to be careful because often that genetic basis that you identify may be a genetic vulnerability to some other cause. In this case, it might be a genetic vulnerability to infection. And recent information that has been generated by some studies indicates that that's just what's happening in Alzheimer's disease and also in atherosclerosis. The genetic basis for those diseases is really, so it seems, genetic basis for vulnerability to an infectious agent that then starts the whole disease process rolling. And then all the other risk factors are factors that exacerbate the progression of the infection and the disease that results from that. Let's look at an example of a disease that had mystified people a little bit, and now people recognize the cause of it, and it was something that we almost immediately could have recognized as a disease caused by infection. What I'm referring to is this epidemic of infertility that was occurring in the 1970s. People were noticing that a lot of women were having a hard time getting pregnant, and so people were wondering, why is this the case? Well, when you actually look at the figures, it's something like 10 to 20% of women were having fertility problems. Now, imagine that those fertility problems were a result of some bad gene. Think of what would happen over the next few generations. Those people who were carrying those genes wouldn't have kids. Those genes would be lost from the population. In really quite short order, the fertility problem would be reduced to the point that you didn't have any fertility problem at all. The point is that the fertility problem decreases fitness so dramatically that if it were caused strictly by a bad gene, it would vanish from the population. You wouldn't see it. The fact that you see it says something else is important. So when my colleague Greg Cochran and I see a disease like that, we would immediately say, ah, probably infection.
The infection in this case turned out to be a type of chlamydia called chlamydia trachomatis. So what are the clues that a particular problem might be infectious rather than genetic or environmental?
If the problem's been going on for a fairly long time, you'd expect that people would evolve resistance to that novel aspect of the environment, especially since, let's say, only 1 out of 10 people would be sensitive. Then you'd expect the same process would occur that I was just describing. The people who are resistant would be the ones that would be passing on their genes at a greater rate relative to the ones who are sensitive. So you come back to having to posit that something that is hard to get rid of is there in the population. And disease organisms are hard to get rid of. They're hard problems to solve, because if you have some people who are resistant to a disease organism now, the disease organism can evolve around that resistance so that in the next generation, the disease organism may have changed. And now it has a new offense to counter what was the best defense in the last generation. So unlike deleterious genes or some non-infectious aspect of the environment, a disease organism is a much more persistent and pernicious adversary. And so when you look at some of these very long-term problems, some things that people might not have thought were infectious, things that might have been around 2,000 years ago, like atherosclerosis, you immediately suspect that those long-term problems are, in fact, caused by infectious agents, even if you don't know the infectious agent at the time. That knowledge should lead you to search hard for those infectious agents. But what's happened really over the last 40 years is that people had been presuming that other factors were causing the diseases that were left, other factors such as bad genes or causes such as pesticides in the environment. And as a result of looking so hard at those possibilities, they've neglected what has turned out to be a much more reasonable hypothesis for most of the diseases that are left without clear-cut causes, and that other possibility is infection.
But, I mean, who could blame them? Isn't it reasonable to look for other causes when no obvious evidence of infections can be found? What's wrong with that?
Well, to some extent, it's non-scientific. Rigorous science dictates that we should keep all hypotheses on the table until we actually have evidence to throw out a particular hypothesis. And the fact of the matter, I think, is that the infectious causation hypotheses were not kept on the table. And sometimes I think this omission has been really fairly dramatic. So, for example, in New York City in late 1940s, some people in some well-respected hospitals were using antibiotics to control peptic ulcers. This was in the late 40s. Now, how did that information get lost? If that therapy was being used and used in mainstream hospitals, and if people were really keeping all of the hypotheses on the table, I don't think that should have been lost. But instead, there were certain factions who were advocating one hypothetical cause of ulcers as opposed to another, sort of environmental cause, stress, say, or high acidity, something like that, instead of another. And without any really good evidence, the infectious causation hypothesis was dropped from the table. And bringing it back on was a very difficult task. In fact, the person who was largely responsible for bringing it back on the table actually went through some sort of intense acrobatics in order to get people's attention. Acrobatics such as drinking a solution that had the bacterium that he was arguing was causing ulcers. And surprisingly, researcher, Marshall, credits an article in the National Enquirer as actually drawing attention to the problem sufficiently that many of the people in medicine began paying the appropriate attention and putting appropriate effort into resolving the problem. So when you see those kinds of scenarios occurring, I think you can only conclude that there isn't a balanced treatment of the alternative explanations. Instead, one or two explanations tends to be left on the table because some particularly powerful people like that explanation, and other explanations just get lost without having evidence that justifies dropping those alternative explanations. And so I think we've been paying a price for the tendency not to consider infectious causation. But what's interesting is that it's really been about a 40-year interval in which this strange bias has occurred, really from about the 1930s up through the 1970s or so. That's the period of time in which people had this sort of bias against infectious causation. I think it was partly because of the great success in identifying infectious agents for the acute infections and the success in controlling them with antibiotics. These other chronic diseases just were thought of as being so completely different from the acute diseases that they must not be caused by infection. If we look at the track record over the last 30 years, those other potential causes of disease really haven't made all that much progress. There's been a good amount of progress in identifying some of the genetic bases of diseases, and there's also been a good amount of progress in identifying agents in the environment, non-infectious agents in the environment. But the really great trend has been the trend for increasing recognition that a lot of these chronic diseases are caused by infection. And what I mean is chronic diseases such as cancers, ulcers, heart disease, atherosclerosis, and now it looks like maybe even mental illnesses may be triggered by infections, things like schizophrenia and manic depression.
Professor Ewald's ideas do have their critics. Dr. Tak Mak in Toronto isn't sure that genetic mutations aren't responsible for certain diseases, especially those like cancer, which strike most people well past their reproductive age.
The major problem is that we, as a race, reproduce, that means have children, earlier than the incidence of cancer, of most cancer. Most of us develop cancer starting from, let's say, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s. By that time, most of us have already reproduced. So the natural selection, in a Darwinian way, is not there. And so, therefore, we are going to develop cancer for many, many, many millions and millions and billions of years.
At Amherst College, I asked Paul Ewald about this. I'm having a little trouble understanding about a whole series of diseases that you mentioned that actually strike people well past their reproductive age. I mean, people get cancer largely when they get old. Alzheimer's is something distinctly associated with elderly people, the same with heart attacks and heart disease. If there were genetic components to these diseases, there's plenty of time for people to reproduce and pass them on to their next of kin.
Right. Because they're so common, they actually have more of a fitness cost than one might think. The real problem in calculating how much of a negative effect they have on our survival and reproduction, is that it's very difficult to know how important the effects of people who are no longer reproducing themselves can be on grandchildren. Older people may have a strong positive effect on their fitness if they're healthy by influencing the survival of grandchildren, even though they're not actually reproducing themselves. So these diseases that hit at old age are in that area where simply by the consideration of evolutionary principles, particularly the principles of fitness and natural selection, one wouldn't know whether they're likely to be infectious or not. But the fact that we're so many of these other chronic diseases that are having negative effects on fitness are turning out to be infectious certainly should encourage us to look and see whether or not some of these other diseases that aren't having such strong negative effects on fitness, either because they're not adversely affecting either reproduction or survival very much, or because even though they are adversely affecting survival, they're affecting that survival late during a person's life. This whole process should allow us to have some confidence that it's in our interest to try to understand whether or not, try to investigate whether or not these diseases might be caused by infection. And the interesting finding then is that data now are implicating infection for many of these chronic diseases that hit late in life, things like Alzheimer's and strokes and atherosclerosis.
To people like David Relman, who are hunting for new causes of disease, Paul Ewald's ideas make a lot of sense.
I'm sympathetic because I think in the end, he and I and many other people end up concluding much the same thing, which is that it is quite possible and even perhaps likely that microorganisms play some kind of role in many kinds of chronic disease. Where we differ somewhat is in the manner by which we arrive at those conclusions. He has applied evolutionary theory in a fairly pure theoretical sense to human disease, and in some cases diseases that don't have a very long time span in human history. They've only been around for a short period of time. So I guess I just have questions about the some of the arguments he's used, but again, the conclusions are things I like and I favor, and I would say that there are equally compelling arguments when we look at the kind of pathology that's associated with chronic disease and the kinds of epidemiologic associations that have been noted for many years with respect to some of these diseases, all of which are bits of information that, again, suggest a possibly infectious cause.
Joseph Penninger, who uncovered the link between heart disease and the bacteria called Chlamydia pneumoniae, finds Paul Ewald's new germ theory intriguing, although he's not prepared to rule out other explanations.
I think it's a very interesting line of thinking, and we should take it very seriously. But we should also be aware there are people out there who are saying exactly the opposite, that as we as a human population have been selected to develop cancer and autoimmune diseases or heart diseases or multiple sclerosis, because during our evolution we have been hit with these waves of pandemics. So bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, the syphilis, which basically killed half of Europe, tuberculosis, of course, and the Spanish flu, which killed more people after the First World War than the First World War itself. So there are some people out there actually saying, because of these pandemics, our immune systems, or our white blood cells, have been selected to be hyperreactive, right? Because only the one people would survive who actually can respond better. But because of this benefit, we also got the bad thing with it, that we would be much more prone to develop multiple sclerosis or diabetes. So this is, of course, the genetic, the old belief it's all genetic. I mean, it makes complete sense to me that the truth, of course, is in the middle. I strongly believe the environmental triggers. Makes lots of sense to me. I mean, there are lots of anecdotal studies which really would indicate the environmental triggers, bacterial infections, exposure to certain viruses during springtime or summertime. But of course, the trigger itself would be genetically regulated. So who would respond against this? And I think that's the real challenge. I mean, just to say that because these bad genes would be selected out, of course, these are also the genes which save us against most of the bacteria. So I think the truth is not that it's just purely genetic why we develop diabetes or multiple sclerosis, heart disease, but it's also not purely environmental.
Paul Ewald.
We're probably going to find these different factors all playing a role, but that's not the same thing as saying that each of the factors is playing an equal role, or each of them is an equally a primary causal factor. I think we're likely to find for a lot of these diseases that the infection is the initiating event. In order to understand why some people are generating disease in response to infection or threat of infection, we'll need to look at genetic predispositions to being infected or maybe having severe disease resulting from infection. And then also we may need to look at non-infectious aspects of the environment, which also may predispose people to having a particularly nasty infection. So I see the eventual resolution of these issues as being one in which a whole variety of these causes will be invoked, a whole variety of these causes will be found to be playing a role. But saying that is not the same thing as saying that they're all playing an equally important role. Everybody's being exposed to chlamydia pneumoniae infection, and in some people the infection generates much more damage than in other people, and presumably those reasons are reasons that in some way depend on other aspects of a person's lifestyle. If a person has high-fat diet or a person has other habits like smoking that may predispose them to have a florid chlamydia pneumoniae infection, then in the lungs, then they may also pay the price of having a much more florid chlamydia pneumoniae infection throughout the rest of the body, and as a consequence may have a higher risk of disease like atherosclerosis. And this would help explain the association between smoking and heart disease, because it's well known that smokers have an increased risk of respiratory tract infections and respiratory tract infections with chlamydia pneumoniae. And so instead of having a direct effect on atherosclerosis and heart disease, smoking may actually have a predisposing effect on atherosclerosis and heart disease, much in the same way that the genetic basis for atherosclerosis and heart disease is apparently more of a predisposing basis. That is, it's a genetic basis that predisposes an individual to becoming infected with chlamydia pneumoniae.
In these two ideas programs, we've heard a lot of evidence that we're at a new frontier in medical thinking. Now that germs are being identified as possible causes of everything from hardening of the arteries to chronic Lyme disease, it seems we're in the middle of what can best be described as a bacteria revolution. David Relman.
Well, it's funny when you use that word because it makes it sound as though these organisms have just up and decided to cause these diseases yesterday. But if, in fact, they or some kind of microorganism is playing an important role in these diseases, they've probably been doing so for quite some time. So that's point one. Point two is I would say that this might be a time of important reevaluation and revisiting, because again, these diseases have been around for some time in many cases. The point now is that we know how to look in a far more sensitive, far more careful and broad-based manner. And I would simply argue that now is the time to revisit some of these diseases with these new methods and see what we find. It may be that we learn about a microorganism only as a cofactor, that there are other things that are absolutely required for one of these diseases to take place. But until we start applying these methods, I think we're going to be stuck with the same kinds of associations and presumptions that we've had simply because our methods have not been terribly sensitive and broad-based. For example, if a cofactor is the host, is host genetics, then I think it's quite clear that in the future we're going to be basically assessing the genetic background of every individual as a patient or as a potential sufferer of disease to understand what kinds of diseases they might be susceptible towards developing. And along those lines, it may be that we start using host genomics, you know, the assessment of the human gene and its responses as a means of even recognizing and understanding human disease. So we haven't touched on this, but there may be ways of looking for the cause of disease, even microbial disease, by looking at the complex, comprehensive responses of human genes in the setting of a particular disease. So that's one kind of implication, that we're going to start to type the host genetically. And the next might be that we can predict, for example, those people who may be at high risk for developing a disease because they're carrying an organism which we know later causes or leads to this particular disease. So we can make predictions about who is at risk and who, for example, might want to avoid certain kinds of other activities that, again, act as cofactors. Thirdly, we're going to have much better ways of diagnosing these diseases, because if we know that a particular sequence, a particular microbial sequence is associated with a particular disease, and that different sequences are associated with different subsets of patients with a particular disease, we're going to be able to categorize people and determine which form of a disease they have and what its natural history is likely to be. And finally, in terms of treatment, it's possible that with the association of a particular organism with a disease will come some insights as to how to treat, either eradicate the organism or suppress the organism or suppress the immune response to that organism, that will all be beneficial for that patient, for that person who is suffering from that particular disease. So I'd say at every level, prediction, risk assessment, diagnosis, treatment, that these sorts of investigations are all going to have important implications and impact.
Microbiology has evolved into a very sophisticated science since the days of Robert Koch. When you compare Koch's simple methods for culturing bacteria to the incredible range of detection techniques available today, it's no wonder we're in the midst of a bacteria revolution. The technology we use governs the way we look at the world. Before the invention of the telescope, we had no way of seeing deep into the cosmos. Likewise, with the microbial universe, these new diagnostic tools are bringing a whole range of previously unknown disease-causing organisms into sharp focus. Correctly interpreting the world of information these tools provide will be a challenge for medicine in the new millennium. I'm Coleman Jones.
The Bacteria Revolution by Coleman Jones, who also composed the music in these ideas programs. Production in Toronto by Max Allen with Dave Fields. And I'm Lister Sinclair. We invite you to visit the Ideas website under www.radio.cbc.ca for an extensive illustrated story about the bacteria revolution. A printed transcript of this two-part Ideas series is available for $14, including taxes and shipping. That's $14 from Ideas, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6, or email ideas@cbc.ca. We'd like to hear from you.
You're listening to CBC Radio 1, News and More.